Dear Heavenly Gracious Father, we do ask your blessing on this Sunday school. Pray that we would learn more about Esther and that this would be beneficial to us and glorifying to you. We ask all this in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, we're studying the book of Esther. This is the second week. Last week I showed you on a map where this was all taking place, and we talked a little bit about where it was happening. And then we did read chapter 1 and talk about it a little bit. I'm going to reread chapters 1 and 2 today. That's what we're going to cover today. And talk more in depth about chapter 1 and 2 and continue with that. And we'll be studying basically two chapters each week until we get done around the first week in January. So, first thing I'm going to do is read the first two chapters of Esther. It doesn't take very long. It's not a terribly long book, but it has lots of interesting things happening. So, Esther chapter 1. Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, this was the Ahasuerus who reigned over 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia, in those days when King Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan, the citadel, that in the third year of his reign he made a feast for all his officials and servants, the powers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of the provinces being before him. When he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellent majesty for many days, 180 days in all. And when these days were completed, the king made a feast lasting 7 days for all the people who were present in Shushan the citadel, from great to small, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were white and blue linen curtains fastened with cords of fine linen and purple on silver rods and marble pillars. And the couches were of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of alabaster, turquoise, and white and black marble. And they served drinks in golden vessels, each vessel being different from the other, with royal wine in abundance, according to the generosity of the king. In accordance with the law, the drinking was not compulsory, for so the king had ordered all the officers of his household that they should do according to each man's pleasure. Queen Vashti also made a feast for the women in the royal palace which belonged to King Ahasuerus. On the 7th day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zethar, and Carcass, 7 eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king, wearing her royal crown in order to show her beauty to the people and the officials, for she was beautiful to behold. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command, brought by his eunuchs. Therefore the king was furious, and his anger burned within him. Then the king said to the wise men who understood the times, for this was the king's manner toward all who knew law and justice, those closest to him being Karshina, Sethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Mirs, Marcena, and Memucan, the 7 princes of Persia and Media, who had access to the king's presence and who ranked highest in the kingdom. What shall we do to Queen Vashti according to law, because she did not obey the command of King Ahasuerus brought to her by the eunuchs? And Memucan answered before the king and the princes, Queen Vashti has not only wronged the king, but also all the princes and all the people who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will become known to all women, so that they will despise their husbands in their eyes. When they report, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought in before him, but she did not come. This very day the noble ladies of Persia and Media will say to all the king's officials that they have heard of the behavior of the queen. Thus there will be excessive contempt and wrath. If it pleases the king, let a royal decree go out from him, and let it be recorded in the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it will not be altered, that Vashti shall come no more before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. When the king's decree, which he will make, is proclaimed throughout all his empire, for it is great, all wives will honor their husbands, both great and small. And the reply pleased the king and the princes, and the king did according to the word of Memucan. Then he sent letters to all the king's provinces, to each province in his own script, and to every people in their own language, that each man should be master of his own house and speak in the language of his own people. And then chapter 2. After these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus subsided, he remembered Vashti, what she had done, and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's servants who attended him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan, the citadel, into the women's quarters, under the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, custodian of the women, and let beauty preparations be given them. Then let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." This thing pleased the king, and he did so. In Shushan, the citadel, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives who had been captured with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. And Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So it was, when the king's command and decree were heard, and when many young women were gathered at Shushan the citadel under the custody of Haggai, that Esther also was taken to the king's palace, into the care of Haggai, the custodian of the women. Now the young woman pleased him, and she obtained his favor. So he readily gave beauty preparations to her, besides her allowance. Then 7 choice maidservants were provided for her from the king's palace, and he moved her and her maidservants to the best place in the house of the women. Esther had not revealed her people or family, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal it. And every day Mordecai paced in front of the court of the women's quarters to learn of Esther's welfare and what was happening to her. Each young woman's turn came to go to King Ahasuerus after she had completed 12 months' preparation according to the regulations for the women, for thus were the days of their preparation apportioned: 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with perfumes and preparations for beautifying women. Thus prepared, each young woman went to the king, and she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the women's quarters to the king's palace. In the evening she went, and in the morning she returned to the second house of the women, to the custody of Sheshgaz, the king's eunuch who kept the concubines. She would not go in to the king again unless the king delighted in her and called for her by name. Now when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter, to go in to the king, she requested nothing but what Haggai, the king's eunuch, the custodian of the women, advised. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. The king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king made a great feast, the feast of Esther, for all his officials and servants, and he proclaimed a holiday in the provinces and gave gifts according to the generosity of the king. When virgins were gathered together a second time, Mordecai sat within the king's gate. Now Esther had not revealed her family and her people, just as Mordecai had charged her, for Esther obeyed the command of Mordecai as when she was brought up by him. In those days, while Mordecai sat within the king's gate, 2 of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh, doorkeepers, became furious and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So the matter became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. And when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed, and both were hanged on a gallows, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. Kind of a long little story, but we're actually getting into it now, and now Esther's shown up, so we know what's happening now, and she's just been made queen. But what I want to do is, like last week, we we talked about chapter 1 some, but went back and did more reading on it, and there's a few other things to point out about it as we go through it. So we'll kind of go through the story as we go, you know, verse by verse, and take a few verses at a time and talk about what they mean. And I've got some other verses to look up. To see where some other things kind of tie into what we're studying. So what I would like is for some folks to look up some Bible verses and read them when it's time to do that. The pastor does that, so I think that works pretty well. Okay, I have Ezra 4:6. Who'd like to take that for me? Okay, thank you. A little later, I have Daniel 5:28. Okay, thank you. And Daniel 8:20. Okay, thank you. We'll look those up for now as we get through this. The story opens with, "Now it came to pass." And this is a typical phrase that is used to introduce history books in the Bible. So it makes us think that this is historical, that this isn't just a story that's been elaborated on. We talked about that some last week. It is in the King James that we're used to reading, but it's not in the Revised Standard Version. And so there's some question as to, is that phrase really part of the Bible? But it is in the version that we were reading today. A little bit about Ahasuerus. That is, his name in Greek is Xerxes, and so you may have heard of him. He did rule from 486 to 465 B.C., and that is mentioned in Ezra. You want to read that passage in Ezra? Read that one more time for me. I'm sorry.
In the reign of Ahasuerus, in the beginning of his reign, they wrote an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem.
Okay. So that was his reign there. Okay, so they're mentioned in his reign also in Ezra. He went up against the Greeks a couple of times. They actually humiliated him twice. This was in 480 and 479. And you're going to see that our story actually starts a little before that and then continues after that time where he went up against the Greeks twice and didn't have a very good outcome with that. He was known for completing and improving the palaces that were begun by Darius, his father, and he consolidated the Persian Empire. And it was at the end of the basically an end of all the opposition they were up against as much. The phrase where it talks about the 127 provinces, that is not the normal breakup that you would talk about for the Persian Empire. It's usually satraps or something, pronounced something like that, satraps, and there's only about 30 or so of those. But when they mention 127, the writer's trying to make it very impressive as to what this man covers, which just by looking at the map, I thought it was a pretty good large area. When it mentions in verse 1 about where he sat on the throne of his kingdom, this again is a phrase that is meant to uplift him, to show how much his power is. Susa had been the capital of Elam, and it had been conquered and then rebuilt by the Persian kings. And so this was a show of power by being in this city and being in this capital. Shushan was the citadel. It's a 10-acre area and Acropolis, and so it's a fortified palace, and it was 120 feet above the city. We talked a little bit about that last week. However, it was only used in the winter months. They actually had three capitals, and this was the southern capital. It was due to the heat because it got to about 120 degrees in the summertime, and so in the summer they would all move north and hold court upper in the northern area. But all of this was meant to exalt the king's importance and also to protect him. That's why he was in this citadel. This did take place in the third year of his reign, which was 483 B.C., the empire's been settled, Susa's been built, and so now it's the time to celebrate. And so he has a 6-month celebration. We were talking about that. There's some question as to the way the author put that there was a feast for 6 months, and then he mentions there's a seven-day feast that we get to at the end of that. Whether that's really two separate feasts or just 6 months of everybody's gathering, and then they have the at the end of that 6 month a seven-day feast. But most folks believe that it is that those are two, basically two feasts, one for 6 months, and then they have the one that's a little smaller that is just for the 1 week up in the citadel. And when they have this, everybody from all over the empire is there. All the princes and all the delegates, the servants, the military leaders, officials, everybody's there and everybody's participating in these banquets. Persian banquets were known to host up to 15,000 guests in that time frame. It's a show of power. It shows how much the king has and what he can do when he can have that kind of a banquet. One thing I found interesting was you'll notice in our story that whenever they mention the leaders of Persia and Media, that this is actually reverse of the way you see it in other books of the Bible. And one example of that is in Daniel, in the two Daniel verses. Daniel 5:28. One's 5:28 and one's 8:20. Okay, so it mentions Medes and then Persians. And then 8:20.
As for the ram that you saw with the two horns, these are the kings of Media and Persia.
Okay. So they mention Media and Persia, and there's significance to the order that you mention those in. And the Persians and Medians are very closely related racially. But up until 550 B.C., the Medes were the dominant group, and so that's why they were mentioned first. And then after 550 B.C., which is where our story takes place, Persia was the dominant race. And so that's why when you're talking about a particular king, you mention his group first. But I found that interesting, and you'll see it as we read through the story. You heard it in the two chapters we read, that each time it was mentioned, it was Persia and Media, where when you see it in like places like Daniel, it's the other way around. So this 6 months or 180 days was a time for him to show off all his stuff, all the things that he had gotten through conquering, taxation, all the different, the gold and the wealth that he has. All the royal treasures were on display. And this was in that time frame when you had all this and showing it off, it translates into his military might because he had this large empire. When people would see all of this and see this six-month party, they would think that, you know, he is pretty strong as military. And so this was also thought that this 6 months, since they had all the rulers and all the military and everybody there, was the time that they were planning the Greek campaign. This would be the campaign that I've already mentioned that he went up against them a couple of years in a row, and he didn't fare very well with that. At the end of this 6 month was that seven-day feast, and in the seven-day feast, everyone in the palace was invited and was participating from the highest all the way down to the lowest servant. They were all invited and all part of it, and this was showing that he had unlimited resources and that he was extra kind and all this greatness. And then it mentions the fine decor of the area where they're all meeting. The mosaic that it mentions that the floor was made out of was a very popular way of doing architecture in that time frame. They would not artificially color the stones and tiles or cut them. They would just find colored stones of different colors and import them from wherever. So it's another way of showing the far reach of the king, that he could go and find all these different colored stones and then bring them back and make this nice mosaic floor. The cloths that they mentioned, the colors of the cloths, and that were the most expensive of dyes. And again, it's showing off more of his wealth and his power. And so then they mentioned the goblets. They were all individually designed. So again, it's all wealth and power and showing off what he's got. And so this was all about showing off what he had, showing his power as they made these plans. the phrase talking about the drinking was not compulsory during the party. Normally, in Persian culture, every time the king would take a drink, everybody else was supposed to take a drink. And so that was the normal protocol. But during this celebration and party, he had suspended that. And he also had commanded that his servants would serve wine to his guests and to the folks at whatever they wanted. They weren't being forced to drink too much, but then again, they were also, it was open bar. They could have as much and or as little as they wanted, and there was no compulsory drinking. And again, it was just to show his kindness and but also how much he had to show off. So then we get into verse 9, and so we've gone through 8 verses, talk about all this greatness that he has, and then there's one verse, and Queen Vashti is having her own banquet over in another part of this area, and she's having it for the women. The commentators and historians were looking at, there's really no no protocol that they've seen before where the women have a separate banquet from the men. So they've got all kinds of different reasons as to why she would have been having her own banquet. Maybe it was a way of showing what kind of power she had within the household, even though she was, you know, the king's wife. Or maybe that the group was just too big for the two banquets to be held in the same area. And so she was hosting hers in another area. But they also said that it could be that the guys' banquet, because it was so opulent and everything was going on, that was a little too much and might be a little upsetting to the ladies' decencies. And so they would have their own party and enjoy what kinds of things that they would do. So there's lots of guesses as to why she's having a separate party, but she is, and she's having her own feast over there. And then, of course, on the 7th day of this 7-day party, the king is merry with wine. It could mean that he was drunk. It probably means that he was very inebriated, if not completely drunk. And he had these, what they call in the Bible is the 7 eunuchs. And eunuchs can mean chief officers or castrates or both. Because these gentlemen had access to the harem, they were, you know, they were very trusted with the king and with the king's harem, because usually that's an off-limits area for other men. And so that's who, those 7 men are the ones that he sent to have her come and show up to him. He was wanting to, you know, show off her beauty to these other men. And then, of course, she refuses to go, and we talked about that last week, as to, you know, there's really, the Bible doesn't say anything about why she refused and why she decided not to come. Lots of reasons may be there. The writer of the story may have left the reasons out just to add extra tension to the story as to, you know, why the king would get so upset that, you know, he didn't know why she wouldn't come. But in this day and age, you know, whatever the king said goes, and even the queen had to do what he said. And so by her not coming, it really made him angry, and that's why he got so upset. There was some discussion about another reason she might not have come was in this area and in this culture, the women usually went around completely covered. They talked about they would go in covered carriages and stuff, that the royal women were never to really be seen by anybody else. So they were always covered up and hidden away from the rest of the world. And Queen Vashti may have thought that this is not an appropriate thing for the queen to do, to be put on display in front of all these people that are at this banquet. But for whatever reason, she didn't show up, and it made him very angry, which ironically, you know, opposes what we just got through talking about how wonderful and awesome he was, because he's having this great party, all this stuff, and he's in charge of this great big area, and there's one person that he can't get to do what he wanted her to do. So it's this writer uses a lot of irony throughout this story to show that. So then in verses 13 to 22, we get to see what the king does about it. In verses 13 and 14, there are seven royal advisors mentioned. These are wise men. This is a typical thing for the Persian kings to do when they're wondering, you know, what kind of decision do I need to make? What's the best thing to do? I've got another verse for somebody to look up, Genesis 41:8. You want to look that up real quick for me? This is another use of, or another example of where a king goes to his advisors. 41:8.
Now it came to pass in the morning that his spirit was troubled, and he sent and called for all the magicians of Egypt and all his wise men, and Pharaoh told them his dreams, but there was no one who could interpret them for Pharaoh.
Okay. So that's where Pharaoh was, you know, calling all his wise men. Whenever anything was going on, kings would call wise men and advisors in to help them make the decision as to what to do. Then in verse 15, it mentions according to law. And this is, you know, he's asking for help according to the law. So it's not just, I'm just wanting to do something out of anger. I'm just mad she didn't show up. He wants to make it sound official that, okay, I want to do something according to the law. I want to make sure I do the right thing. And so that's why he is looking to get some help on this to make sure they're doing it. And in verse 19, you'll see that when, in verse 19, let's see if I can find it here quickly. It mentions Vashti in the middle of verse 19, that Vashti shall come no more to King Ashurus. And it doesn't use the word queen, doesn't give her title in front of her name. And from this point on in this story, her title is not used with her name. So it's very telling at that point that it's going to happen. And so when she is, what this decree is talking about is they're not going to kill her or put her to death. He's just basically demoting her from queen, divorcing her, and she's put away and exiled, never to be seen by the king again. So it's a way of punishing her for that. And so he will never, you know, set eyes on her again. She won't have access to him anymore. Access to the king is a very big deal. Only certain people have access to him. And so that's part of what's going on there. When in the verse where it says another who is better than she, when he's talking about finding someone to replace her, it's at the end of verse 19. This kind of gives a foreshadow of how the story is going to continue, and that's where we get into chapter 2, and we find out where he can find someone better than Vashti. In verses 21 and 22, when he decides that this is what he wants to do, it pleases him, and the princes, and makes, you know, it's what everybody should do. He decides to send out the letters to all the king's provinces. Well, due to the fact that they've got this big gathering of all these people from all over the Persian Empire, they already have everyone there that has all the different languages and stuff of the Persian Empire, so they have plenty of people that can translate his command into all their different languages and can get it out even faster. And we also talked about last week that the Persian Empire was also known for having a great mail service. I read that it was a lot like what our Pony Express was. They had horses and men at different stages and different places so they could get information out very quickly throughout the empire. And so that's where they would send out the decree to everybody and send that out. Another point of irony at this point is that it's a reference, they reference the laws that these kings make that they could never be repealed. But you can notice here that at the whim of a king that's been partying for 6 months and probably pretty inebriated, he can all of a sudden make a brand new law and then send it out and it becomes law very quickly. It's kind of ironic how you can have such an important law, but it can be made at any time. So that brings us to chapter 2, where we find out about Esther being chosen. In the first couple of verses, it talks about after these, it starts out as after these things, when the wrath of the king had subsided, that he remembered Vashti. So this makes it sound like this happened, you know, very shortly after the time that he had sent out this decree. But we're going to see a little bit later that this may not have happened right away. At this point, this is where they went, and he went on the went to Greece and fought there for a couple of years. And then he, from other places, they know that he, on his way back to Susa, he had wintered at another palace before he got back to Susa. So there's actually about 3 years that elapse before he gets back. So, but at any point, when it talks about that he remembered Vashti, it may show that he may have regretted what he had done, that, you know, she had been an important queen, had been his wife, and that he cared for her, but that because of the law is the law and cannot be revoked, there wasn't anything he could do about it. And so then when his servants realized that he was probably, you know, he was kind of sad missing Vashti, he's gone off and fought the Greeks, and now he's wintering, and, you know, now he's lonely because the queen's not around, they pick up on that, and so they suggest that he do what his advisor had suggested and try to find a new queen. So then, in verses 5 through 11, the writer takes kind of a step back to introduce us to Esther and Mordecai to give us an idea of who they are and what their heritage is. And especially Mordecai's heritage comes into play in next week's lesson when we get to talking about his conflict with Haman. But so they talk about Mordecai. He is of the tribe of Benjamin. They mention Kish, the father of Saul, and Shimei, cursed by David. There's some verses that we can look up to see where those are mentioned previously in the Bible. 1 Samuel 9, 1 and 2. Okay? And then 14:51 in 1 Samuel also. Would you take that? And then I have a 2 Samuel 16:5. Would you take that for me? So 1 Samuel 9, 1 and 2 mentions Kish, who is the father of Saul.
There was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, the son of Bechorah, the son of Ephiah, Benjaminite, a man of wealth, and he had a son whose name was Saul, a handsome young man, and there was not a man among the people of Israel more handsome than he. From his shoulders upward, he was taller than any of the people.
Okay. And then 14:51, it's also mentioned. Okay, so this kind of ties in where, you know, where Mordecai has come from. And then in 2 Samuel 16:5.
Now when King David came to Bahurim, there was a man from the family of the house of Saul whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera, coming from there. He came out cursing continuously as he came.
Okay, so he was cursing David when David showed up. And so, and we know that, you know, Saul and David were enemies. And so so mentioning Kish and Shimei in Mordecai's background, it's not a direct, the Bible typically does not mention everybody in the ancestry. They pick out the important ones. And so the reason that the writer would pick these out was to point out that, you know, Mordecai is from the tribe of Benjamin, which is going to be the enemies of where Haman comes from, and we'll be introduced to him next week in chapter 3. So that's why that's important to know. Then in verse 7, they introduce Hadassah. Hadassah is the Hebrew name for Esther, and it says that there. This Hebrew name means myrtle, which is a plant in the area. It also has prophetic symbolism. I found this very interesting that the prophecy is that the myrtle would replace the briars and thorns of the desert, depicting the Lord's forgiveness and acceptance of his people. And we have a couple of more verses there. Isaiah 41:19. Okay. And Isaiah 55:13. Anybody want to? That's fine. You want to take it? Okay. He'll take 55:13 over here. So, Doug, you got 41:19?
Tree and the pine,
Okay, and 55:13.
Instead of the thorn brush will grow the pine tree, and instead of the briars the myrtle will grow. This will be for the Lord's grant, renown, for their everlasting sign, which will not be destroyed.
Okay. So her name, as a lot of names in the Bible, have some meaning as to what's going to happen in the story, and what happens with her. So that's where Esther's name comes from. And she is, as it mentions, she's adopted by her cousin Mordecai when her parents died. Then in verse 8, she's taken into the custody of Haggai, and he's the custodian of the women. This was because of the king's decree that all the prettiest girls in the empire are to be gathered together and prepared for him to choose a new wife. She was also taken at that time in verse 8. And then in verse 9, we see that she obtained his favor. And this is another biblical term that comes up a lot. This is mentioned here in kind of a secular kind of setting. Because again, this book doesn't mention anything about God, but in Daniel 1:9, Daniel receives the favor of the king at the time, and it mentions that it directly mentions that's due to God's hand that he receives that favor. So that's a linking of this story to other biblical stories, that even though God's not directly mentioned here, this favor that she obtained is, you know, due to what God has been able to do and put her in this position, that she was able to get this custodian of women to really like her. And so what he does is he gives her everything she needs and gives her extra help in preparing to become queen. In verse 10, there's a couple of signs that she shows good wisdom. And let's look up real quickly Proverbs 13:3 and Proverbs 13:1. One person can probably look up both of those. You got that? Okay. Should have given these out ahead of time, but
mm-hmm. Whoever guards his mouth preserves his life. He who opens wide his lips comes to ruin.
And what it mentions in verse 10 is that she was quiet about being Jewish. She didn't talk about or tell anybody what her ancestry was, because the likelihood that they would choose a Jewish woman to go in and become the queen is not going to happen. And so in the Proverbs 13:1, it talks about listening to those that are, you know, that raised you. And Mordecai raised her, and he suggested that she not say anything, so she was following his direction. And then she was smart and kept her mouth shut for the time to protect her life at the time. So it shows some wisdom there. And then verse 11, where Mordecai's hanging out outside to check on her regularly, because now he's not taking care of her anymore. She's now in the king's group, and it just shows his love and concern for her, and that continues. Verses 12 through 18, need to speed up because we're starting to run out of time. This is where it describes the preparation of the women. It does take a year to do it, 6 months of oil of myrrh, 6 months of perfumes and beauty treatments, which one mentioned that it includes things like fumigation, which I found that an interesting word to talk about, hair plucking and lightening of the skin color, just doing everything they can, basically trying to clean up any blemishes or anything that these women might have and make them just absolutely perfect for when they go to show up for the king. It goes through and talks about that before the woman goes to the king to see if she is selected, she gets to pick out her outfit. She gets to pick out what she adorns herself with when she goes to present herself to the king. And this is actually a test to find out if they have good taste or if they're just going to be enriching themselves. And, so this is a time where their personality can have something to do with what they do. They go in, they have one night with the king, and then the next morning they're turned back over to another one of the king's women's keepers, and then goes to the concubine's house and possibly never to see the king again. So this wasn't a great thing for all these young women to be gathered up, because they spend a year getting ready. They go in one evening to the king. The next morning they go back and may never get to see the king again. And then they're hanging out with this group of women for the rest of their life. So, and some of them enjoyed that, but some of them didn't. But basically they didn't have a whole lot of opportunity to do much else. So this is not necessarily a great thing unless you happen to be Esther, who gets chosen. Because when she shows up, when it's her turn to go, she actually does what Haggai had suggested. So she again was showing wisdom and listening to those that were giving her guidance, instead of just choosing what she wanted to choose to wear to take in when she went to the king. Haggai, who had obviously been with the king for quite some time, knew what the king would like and was able to give her guidance. And also with her beauty that she already had, the king, fell in love with her immediately and immediately made her queen. Then had another banquet. You'll see that this whole story, we keep having banquets after banquets. They do a lot of banqueting. So they have another banquet to celebrate. He also gives basically a day off, declares a national holiday, and gives gifts to everybody. They say it could have been food. It could have been reducing taxes. It could have even been, at some point, releasing prisoners and that sort of thing. So this was a big deal that they were celebrating having a new queen. And this did occur in the seventh year of his reign, which means that the women had started back in the sixth year of his reign, which, you remember, the first party was in his third year. So there was a three-year gap in this story. When you're first reading it, if you don't pay attention to the dates that they give you, you may not pick up on that. But that was one of the things that interested me, was that, you know, he had gotten rid of Vashti in his third year, and then it was in his seventh year that he actually got to choose a new queen. And so that's when this took place. The last thing that occurs after she becomes queen is that Mordecai discovers a plot to kill the king. And you'd think that this would really get him in good with the king, because he discovered it, and it turns out to be true that these two members of the court are planning on laying hands on the king and murdering him. Now, one of the things that this talks about is that Mordecai was at the king's gate. The king's gate is an area where justice is rendered. This is like the court. This is where folks can come to the judges and all that of the king. And so the understanding is that when Esther became queen, that she was able to get Mordecai promoted and given this position as being a judge or a magistrate in the king's court, and that's why he was there, which put him in a position to overhear what other members of the court, members of the officials might be saying and talking about the king. This position is not really considered a really high position within the palace. There were higher areas, and she probably could have asked to get him into a higher position. But if she had done that, it again might have risked folks finding out that she was also Jewish. It's obvious here that they know Mordecai is Jewish, and there is a lot of history where the Jewish people would find elevated positions within the different kingdoms. So it is something that definitely happens more often than not. So he was in a position where he could overhear these guys talking about wanting to kill the king. Something that I found was very interesting is, well, first of all, so he told Esther told the king in Mordecai's name, so that the king would know that this information had come from Mordecai. They do find out that this was true, that these guys were out to kill the king. And so then they were tried and they were hanged on the gallows, as it says. But that's not a rope hanging. The typical thing that they did was there'd be a sharp post and they'd display the body stuck on this post, and they were never buried. They were just there and left to the elements and the animals and all that kind of stuff. So this was a pretty bad thing. It's a type of crucifixion. And so this was a pretty big deal. And so then it concludes that This incident was written up in the book of Chronicles in front of the king, so the king knows it happened and all this was done and that Mordecai had helped him, but he doesn't do anything for Mordecai. It's like, no thank you, no promotion because you saved my life or anything like that. It's just recorded in the book of Chronicles of the king. So that's where we're at. They're introduced, and Mordecai getting promoted to this position actually makes somebody else very mad that we're going to find out about in chapter 3 when Haman comes in. He's not real thrilled that this Jewish guy is in there and is of such importance, and also something else happens. So that's what's getting ready to come up, and that's kind of the cliffhanger for next week. We'll go into chapters 3 and 4, and it's time to close, so I'll close in a quick word of prayer. Dear Heavenly Gracious Father, thank you for your word brought to us, and thank you for helping us to understand this story. Father, now be with us as we go up to worship you. Help us to worship you in spirit and truth. We ask all this in Jesus' name. Amen.